Subcommittee on Employee Relations back to order. And I know that the Senate has to go back in at 3:00. We have a couple senators that are delayed a little bit. I believe Senator Benson will not probably join us this time. What we're going to do is I'm going to take testimony. We'll do member questions at the end, just so that we can get through all the folks that have been here and spent their time with us. Thank you so much for staying with us. We will do, I'll kind of go back and forth between the two different sides at this point, since now we have a little bit more time in front of us. So I'm going to start with MMPCA, and I'm not sure where you are in your list and who's still here, so maybe if Ms. Crockett could kind of organize those who would like to come up. And on my list from SCIU, I have Jamie, is it Gully? Are you still here? Okay, so you'll be next after this, the next testifier from MNPCA.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kim Crockett with Center of the American Experiment and working with MNPCA. We have two testifiers today from a home health care agency in the Grand Rapids area. A little different perspective than personal care attendants that you heard from earlier.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Carla Henning, and I am a co-owner operator of 4U Home Healthcare in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. We currently have approximately 100 clients, 120 employees. It varies from day to day. We currently have only 4 clients that are covered under the PCA choice program. We have obviously a strong majority of our clients that are enrolled in the PCPO program, otherwise known as traditional. A big part of this factor is because it is due to the fact that we educate our clients about what the programs are and how they work. We have heard that today many times, and about this being about the choice program and the need for the choice program. No argument. The choice program is very much needed, as well as the traditional program. They both have different responsibilities of the client and the companies. And the problem that we are seeing is that DHS is, along with the counties, are going into clients, and what we see is, and what we're being told by these clients is, do you want to be able to choose your own PCA, who that is? Well, yes, I do. Well, then you have to be part of the choice program. And it's pushing all these people into a choice program, whether they can carry those responsibilities of being a choice client or not. And so it's become an imbalance that then comes back to us as a company to educate them to do that. Through this process of having clients and employees that come with them that change companies or are starting out new, we are hearing some of the same stories that you've heard today over and over from people that are, you know, I never signed anything, and yet they're taking dues from me. They are sending me stuff, and I signed it. It's just to get more information. Suddenly I'm part of a union, and I don't want to be. We have heard this over and over. And we do have clients that have said, I want to purposely change from the choice program into the traditional program so that my employees don't have to be part of this union. It's the only way I can get them to stop taking dues from these employees. Some of what we see as a company is a different perspective, because we're looking at our employees too, and I want to answer the question. It wasn't part of what I was even planning to say today. But the question today about, do these PCAs deserve the raises and vacation time and all these things? Absolutely, yes. I want to see my people be paid for what they do, because they do an amazing job that I can't even comprehend. I sit in an office because I'm not capable of what they do. They are such loving, caring people to be caring for, whether it's a family member or not. They do amazing things, and they aren't paid what they should be paid. But DHS gives us rules as a company that says, here's your reimbursement rate. Here's what you're going to pay 72.5% of that to your employees. And you have 27.5% to operate the rest of your business costs and overhead and everything else. Well, if that's the case, they have already set those rules in place. Why is there a union? That is because DHS, to me, they are not following through and making us accountable for those demands on where that money is spent and that it goes to those employees. And I hear it many times from employees coming into our company, well, yeah, I'm coming from this other company and they were paying me minimum wage. Well, there's no accountability to companies. We hold ourselves accountable because we never get anybody checking up on us. And we gladly open anything up because we want to make sure our employees are taken care of. So the union coming in, to me, all it's done to my employees is in their union dues was to give them vacation time was the only thing extra, which by doing that, it costs them more in dues than if they'd have just put that same money into a savings account for their vacation time. The other part is as a company, it's costing more. So now that 72.5%, I'm now running at 75%+. And now I'm being told that we're getting 4 cents an hour raise in reimbursement, but we're raising the minimum wage. The union is saying you got to raise those people up 25 cents an hour. That happened last year also. Those numbers are starting to go the opposite way, pushing me as a business owner to start questioning whether I can stay afloat in caring for people that have the choice program, because it's pushing those percentages to be upside down to be able to afford to give to these employees. So my answer, yes, they deserve it. I would hope that legislation and DHS follows through with all of that. Do we need a union to do that? No. And I honestly, in from what I've heard today, from even the same from my employees, they're getting the same thing of why don't they have the right to have that vote again? It's who's representing them.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony. Yep.
My name is Denise Keezy, and I am Carlos' business partner, but I also have been in the PCA field as a RN, qualified professional, for 18 years. I have three daughters that also are PCAs, so I can look at it from a lot of different standpoints. I've seen how the PCA program has changed throughout the years. I have also spent many multiple hours out in the field working as a PCA when I didn't have staff to go in to help somebody. I know how grueling the job is, and the amount of wages, again, is not worth what they get paid. But again, I think that comes back to legislature. I think it comes back to the companies of not reimbursing their employees like they should. As I said earlier, we are a completely different company, I think, than most, but our employees matter. We provide training for them out of our own pockets for CPR, for first aid, for mental health training, for multiple things. We send them out to classes and we do in-house classes. I don't need a union to tell me to do that. That is a good employer, what we should do. So I think, again, that is what I think bottom line comes from. If it was any of you guys that had somebody at home that needed special services done, would you want somebody getting paid $10, $11 an hour that has no training or that doesn't have the will to work? Or would you want somebody who is well trained, who wants to do it and can get paid a decent wage? I mean, $13.50, honestly, that's not even worth it for what some of these people do. They should be making way more than that. And 4 cents an hour that we get for the last 10 years, doesn't even come close to it. So bottom line, and I am a union person, I fully like unions, I have nothing against them, but the union can't help. Legislature has to do it. It's up to you guys and the rest of the government to help these employees get what they need so that they can work and we can have good, reliable, trustworthy people out there. And companies need to be held accountable, which also does not happen. Because every single one of you guys sitting over there that are the clients or the caregivers, you deserve to have what we feel we give all of our employees. So
thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I was going to take questions, member questions, at the end, but just so we can get through the public. Is that all right? Okay. So we will take the public testimony at the end, and we had another member join us. So the plan, Senator Newman, is we're going to go back and forth between the two sides, and we'll take member questions at the end just so that we can get them their time since they've waited all day to be able to present in front of us. Okay, so we have Jamie Gully. Thank you, Representative Hellstrom, for noting that detail.
Thank you.
So state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Absolutely. My name is Jamie Gully. Chairman O'Neill, members of the subcommittee, good morning, good afternoon, actually, at this point. I have the honor of serving as the elected president of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota, a union representing 43,000 caregivers in Minnesota, including 27,000 home care workers. Home care affects people in every community in the state. Here in the room today and this morning, we had workers and clients from around the state, from Winnebago, Chisholm, Red Wing, Crosby, Annandale, along with folks from across the Twin Cities. Some of them had to leave to get back to their clients this afternoon, and unfortunately aren't able to be here for this part of the testimony, but they did want to make sure that their voices were heard. Just as a little bit of background, our union is the oldest union of healthcare workers in America. If you need care, you're not going to find a better place in the world or a more knowledgeable and caring workforce than what is delivered by the SEIU healthcare members right here in Minnesota. The true story of the Home Care Workers Union in Minnesota looks nothing like the story told by our opponents. In 2011, the minimum rate of pay for PCAs was the state minimum wage of $6.15 an hour. There were no benefits provided to home care workers in Minnesota, no sick days, no holiday pay, no free access to basic training like CPR and first aid, nothing. Despite the extremely low pay and lack of benefits, the legislature cut pay for home care workers that year, an across-the-board cut of 1.5%. And if you were caring for a family member, your pay was cut by 21.5%. That year, home care workers began calling our union in droves, and we launched an effort to help home care workers gain a voice in the decisions that affect their lives, to raise pay and provide some of the very basic, modest benefits for home care workers to improve their lives and their ability to care for clients. With the help of both Republican and Democratic legislatures, we introduced a bipartisan bill to allow home care workers the same right to form a union that teachers, nurses, and other public sector workers have. In 2013, our bipartisan bill was merged with another bill seeking to allow child care workers the right to organize a union. And because of the controversy around the child care side of the bill, we lost Republican support, and the legislation was passed with only DFL votes in the House and Senate. But the effort of caregivers to build an organization that would advocate for better standards and improved care has always been bipartisan, not some sort of backroom deal. The need for decent pay and benefits for this growing critical workforce has not been and should not be a partisan issue. Some home care workers filed for their union election, since home care workers, excuse me, filed for their union election. Despite filing for an open shop union, we have faced an unprecedented, frankly incredible barrage of litigation, frivolous legal challenges, and dishonest attacks. Even though there were 27,000 eligible voters in the 2014 union election, not one worker filed a complaint or challenge about the election or process with BMS. Doug Seaton did file an objection to the election process with BMS in 2014. And like all of his subsequent challenges, this one was dismissed. He did not attempt to appeal that BMS ruling in 2014. That same year, he also attempted a legal claim that challenged the legal right of home care workers to decide for themselves if they want to form a union. This legal case was dismissed by the chief judge of the Federal District Court in Minneapolis, then by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the United States Supreme Court declined to hear this case. Following years of fruitless legal claims that were rejected by every court in the U.S. court system, Mr. Seaton decided to launch a new effort to decertify the union. He partnered with the Center for the American Experiment, which is ideologically opposed to unions, and which has publicly advocated for massive cuts to the Medicaid system on which people with disabilities and seniors who receive care depend. The claims against our union have grown more silly and outlandish with time as their attempts to win support from actual home care workers has failed. The fact remains that home care workers support their union. We operate on an open shop basis. Every home care worker benefits from our advocacy and the contract, including lots of great improvements in the contract I hope this committee will come to consider and support. Many home care workers have chosen to be members of our union and to pay dues. Many others do not. It is because of the high level of support home care workers have for the union that our opponents have been unable to get even close to a 30% showing of interest for a decertification election. Failing to find support in the courts or among home care workers themselves, Doug Seaton and others are now bringing forward two-year-old concerns about union dues that were investigated, found to be without merit, and nevertheless addressed and resolved a long time ago. No court filing has ever been made against our union, not even a small claims court filing based on our dues processes. Our union has extensive controls in place to make sure that no dues are deducted from any home care worker who does not affirmatively opt into union membership. If a worker resigns their membership, which of course they have every right to do, we make sure to process those immediately so that no dues are deducted after a membership resignation is complete. The cases mentioned by Mr. Seaton in the affidavits all were from when our first contract went into effect in July of 2015. They were all investigated and found to be without merit. Where one worker claimed we did not process a membership resignation in a timely manner, we have records of all communications with her, and our turnaround from first message to the successful completion of the resignation process was 3 calendar days. In the 2 cases where workers alleged a forged signature, the union investigated those claims and found that we in fact did have cards with their valid signatures on them. Nevertheless, we refunded every penny of dues each of them had paid because we have no interest in having any worker as a member who doesn't want to be one. The final comment I'd like to make is that there is a very serious crisis in the home care industry. As you heard from Dolores, and as you will hear from other leaders from this union who have the opportunity to speak to here today, there are an estimated 8,000 vacancies in home care in Minnesota due to the low pay and lack of benefits. Thousands of clients are not getting the care they need. They could end up in institutions that cost taxpayers substantially more money than paying for our new contract. The contract we negotiated with the state of Minnesota represents major steps forward toward addressing that crisis. That is what should be the focus for anyone, regardless of political party, who is concerned about the well-being of seniors and people with disabilities in our state. I hope you will consider our contract and affirm it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, back to MNPCA. Ms. Crockett, did you want to just manage the list? You want to just manage the list? Okay, go ahead. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Madam Chair, representatives, thank you so much for having me here. My name is Catherine Hunter. I am a mom and a PCA. I have 4 my children at home. I'm a former teacher. I'm not anti-union. I am not, however, in support of this union or this contract. And there are many reasons for that. I'll try to keep it brief. For many of us, this isn't a job that we chose, but it is one that chose us. As a former teacher, I know that my union dues were not as high as what the SEIU charges PCAs now who join the union. And what I have heard oftentimes is that, well, you don't have to pay dues. I don't personally have to pay dues because of Harris v. Quinn. And I won't go into details with that right now, but most of you, I think, know what that is. And so I don't personally have to pay dues if I choose not to. However, the SEIU still represents me, but they don't have an ear for me. If I call them and say, I have a concern about this, that, or the other thing, they don't necessarily care about my concerns because while they represent me, I don't pay them dues. So I am not a member. I do not get invited to trainings that are available through the SEIU because I am not a dues paying member, but they still represent me. They also, their representation therefore silences me before you because as union contracts are accepted and put forth, I have to go through my representation not you. I can't come to you straightforward like this. And that bothers me. In the past, the legislature has done a very, very nice job, I believe, in taking care of us. And I'm very happy with the wages that I make to take care of my children. And I am very thankful for this program. I don't want that to go unnoticed. This program means the world to our family. Representatives Hillstrom and Lilly asked of us, would we want these benefits that are listed in the contract? Do you want a higher wage or do you want holiday pay? For me personally, holiday pay is kind of a moot point, but earlier in the first hearing, the first part of the hearing, you asked, would we want that? And I would say, I do not want the union for this contract ratified right now for so many reasons that would have been mentioned before, but partly because I want an opportunity to see this decertification election through. And if there is no problem and everybody really is in support of the SEIU, then there should be no concern with giving us that voice, giving us that chance to share. But I will tell you, do I think that it would be nice to give PCAs or some of my son's PCAs who work for me, you know, to take care of them, a raise? Certainly, and the legislature's done a nice job of that. And I am assuming that you would support that with or without the union. That's my assumption, like you've done in the past. So that's my response to that question. I guess I'll close at that point and just tell you once again how very thankful I am that you've given us a chance to talk today, but also how very thankful I am for this program and that it means everything to us. I know that there's a limited amount of taxpayer funding for this program, and I don't want to see people lose hours, lose benefits, or anything else because there are unfunded mandates, because I know there's a limited pot of money out there. And thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, we're going to go back to the SEIU list. I have Clara Nakumbi. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
My name is Clara Nakumbi. And I want to thank you so much for having us come back this afternoon and being able to speak to you. One of the things, the first thing I want to say that I heard that was said earlier on in at the first meeting that we were being paid to be here. That certainly is not true. I'm here because of my concern for my son, Saran Bogan, whose picture is being passed around. I'm a home care worker for him. I've been caring for him for 15 years. He was diagnosed with MS. And I didn't realize that there were many forms of MS. I just thought MS was MS. But I found out as we got further down in the line that there's many kinds. And the kind that he have is the severe kind. Sight, everything have to be done for him. Pureed food. This is what me and one of his siblings is having to take care of him. My son was a graduate of Howard University, had a degree in chemistry. He thought he would be on his way working. This happened to him. And because of it, it's made him immobile and unable to understand a lot. When he speaks, you cannot understand what he's saying. I can, because I deal with him, you know, during the day. He needs 24-hour care. The state only allows so many, but we still hang in there and do the other hours with no pay. He's a wonderful young man. He deserves to be cared and dignified in his home. Before SEIU come into my home, and we talked about becoming a part of the union, we had low pay, no benefits, and the industry makes me scared for Saran's care, because if my family wasn't there, I don't know, you know, what we would do. The basic things that we have fought for is paid training, higher pay and paid sick leave. And as a mom, I'm not going to even get into the sick leave because I'm the mother, and that's it. People expect me to do that. The things that mean a lot to the people doing this work, we also have to have the right people in this doing this job. And in order to get decent people into this field, you have to have decent pay. Because if you don't have decent pay, it's the last thing they're going to want to do. And it's a field that everybody can't do it. Everybody can't care for somebody, children or whoever. If your child certainly needs round-the-clock care, wouldn't you want to make sure that the job was treated like a career? Before the union, home care was treated like a temporary job because of lack of pay and benefits. Think of that. Taking care of someone else's son, daughter, mother, father, or grandparents isn't considered a real job. That's just wrong. None of us who's sitting in this room will never know or don't know what we are going to come to. And we might need this care. So my coming to you and asking you is, with our new contract that you supported and that we can get the benefits that we so much need to stay in this field, and it's sad to hear people attacked in the hard work that's being done here with different family members and other people that are being cared for. We should be thinking about the future of what's going to happen to our people as they get sick, and they're going to need it. And I, as a senior for one, am concerned about maybe I might need this care one day, and I certainly would like to have people in place to take care of me. We deserve the best. Our union is fighting to bring that reality to the families. And I hope that the legislature will support our contracts in doing this. It's a lot of things that are out there, but we need good health care. I hope you will take us into consideration and hear the truth when you hear, and not, we shouldn't be fighting about the care, who given it, who don't want to be a union in a union. The union, to me, I'm doing this because I want to be a part of it. I'm not forced to pay dues. I'm not forced to be a part of that. This is my own doing. So thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, back to MNPCA, testifier. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
My name is Mary Welty, and I am here and to answer Representative Itz Hillstrom. A question first, I do not support going forward at this time with what is being proposed, and I'll explain to you briefly why. I am the mother of a 26-year-old who has brain injury. I've been in the PCA waiver system for almost 23 years. I've seen a lot of changes. And I did want a response to the gentleman's statement of wages being as low as six something an hour in 2011. No, that's not my recollection. I think that's incorrect. But I also understand that starting in 2014, I had many, many calls, visits to my home from what were union people asking me about joining. At that time, I was like, well, this is great. I mean, there are people that might need this. This is my family, and I don't think of it as a job the way it may be for others. And I was a little offended when I'm out in the yard and someone's actually looking in my door. It got to the point where I actually put a no solicitation sign on my door because they were coming so often. I live in Minneapolis, so I realized it's close. And I was also getting tons of phone calls, emails, and at some point or another, I know that I looked at something. I know that there was information they gave me, but again, as a clinical social worker, I was supportive of people having better benefits and working in these positions, but I myself was not necessarily seeing it as something that directly affected me all through this period of time. I didn't pay attention when they started taking union dues out of my check. It was told later it was in the late or summer of 15. And the first I even thought about this strongly was when I got a letter from a Senator Dan Hill and read the letter, and I was concerned and started researching it further. And I also contacted my fiscal and said, what's going on here? My union dues are higher than what I pay as a county social worker every month. It seemed extreme to me, and I was wondering, what is the formula that they base that on? I started asking more questions, and I also contacted the SEIU, spoke to them and said, I don't want to be a part of this. If I did sign something, please send it to me. I don't recall agreeing to this, and I don't think that what you're asking, the money you're asking for, is too much for what you're doing. And knowing the plan as well as I do through my work, I didn't see the benefit of what they were doing either. They said they never did anything. 3-4 weeks passed. I called Orion again. No, we haven't received any notification from them. When I spoke to them and when I talked to Orion, they said all I had to do was tell them. When I phoned them back the second time, they said, no, there's a form. Well, I said, I'm off work today. Why don't I come over there and I'll sign it there? No, it has to be done in the mail. I said, do you have a copy of this card that I signed? Yes, yes, we do, and we show that we told you this. I said, would you send that to me in the mail? The next day, Orion called me and said that they had stopped my union dues, and within 2 days, I had a check for 2 months' worth of union dues in the mail. This is very suspicious to me, and I want to address also Doctor, I don't know if you're a doctor or not, Representative Hillstrom. To me, if they are taking money out of my check, and it is federal and state monies that do fund these programs, I see that as fraud. If I did legitimately sign something, let me know, but there was just so many things going on through all this period of time, not to mention they started calling my minor son, who said my 17-year-old, and I kept telling them repeatedly not to bother me, not to come to my home, and not to send me emails. So there's something very suspicious here, and I appreciate your time, and as someone who's caring for an individual in my home, I can't really support going forward on the programs that you're, the path that you're on right now. I'm more worried about what's going to happen to my son when I'm dead, and he's worried about it too. There are no group homes, there are no day programs, all these things are shutting down, moratoriums, I'm very aware of this. So for me to support the other piece of this right now is hard when my own son said to me, Mom, I'm worried about who's going to take care of me when you're dead. I am too, I'm a boomer. And when all of our children are out there and we're gone, that's the future of this program as well. And I hope that you think about that as you make these decisions. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there a Corey Vandenberg still here? Great, you were next on the list. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Chair O'Neill and committee, my name is Corey Vandenberg. I live in rural Oak Grove on a hobby farm north of the cities here. I've been a home care worker for 11 years now. In 2014, home care workers began collecting cards to request a union election, and with a massive effort, were able to collect and submit more than 10,000 cards from workers on the state's official list, triggering the election. We petitioned, it's important to note, for a union that would be open shop, that would have no fair share fees, and it would exist on a right-to-work basis. The Minnesota Home Care Workers Union only accepts dues from workers who have opted into the union membership by signing a membership card. We won the election with more than 60% support. The level of voter participation in our home care union election was very similar to the levels of voter participation in the two 2017 special elections to fill state house seats. Participation was a bit higher in District 32B and a bit lower in 50B. The results of those two very close state house elections were valid because we live in a republic where the voters choose. As a strong conservative, I am proud of the system that exists in the US, and I'm proud of the manner in which our election was conducted. The first contract for home care workers made huge improvements for the lives of those individuals, as you'll hear from the many people who have already talked and will continue to testify today. The 2015 contract approval and funding bills included a large bipartisan group of authors, and they were approved by the Republican House and a DFL Senate. The attacks and lawsuits from MMPCA would do nothing to fix a frightening situation that my sister Lily and my family faced this past fall. If our industry has moved backwards, it would make things worse. Their attacks offer no solutions to the thousands of Minnesotans who need quality care to stay in their homes. I hope we can move beyond all of this and towards fixing our home care crisis by passing our new contract in the coming weeks here.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, Ms. Crockett, do you have someone else? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Evan Van Hoover. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for hearing us today and this morning, this afternoon. I started last August with MNPCA in the canvassing efforts, and so different from many of the testimonies today, I am not a PCA. I do not do in-home care work as an official PCA. However, I do care for many members in my family, namely a mentally challenged step aunt who is about 75, but mentally 8 years old, and I've been caring for her since I was about 7 years old. When I started canvassing in August, I didn't know a lot of specifics about the PCA program. I didn't know a lot of specifics about the union. I was very afraid when Right to Work came to Minnesota because my dad is a part of a labor union. He's been part of a labor union for 30 years, and without the union, we would not have got through the recession. We would not have kept his home. My life through high school would not have been the same, and so I'm very happy for my father and for the benefits that the labor union had for him. However, when I started canvassing and talking to PCAs since last August, I've talked to over 200, maybe 300 PCAs, and of those 300 PCAs that I've talked to, or 300 or so PCAs that I've talked to, I would say I've talked to maybe five in support of the union, which I respect their opinions, their beliefs. I never tried to force my agenda on them by any means. I respected exactly where they came from. However, the other 295 or so that I talked to that were not in favor of the union expressed many concerns about this union. I firsthand experienced a lot of fraud with the many lists that we received. Like you heard earlier, we received seven lists from the state, the lists that the state was supposed to keep on a monthly basis. They did not keep. We received seven lists. One from 18,000 names, the other to 28,000 names, and if there are truly 27,000 PCAs in this program, it baffles me a little bit that we had lists ranging from 18,000, which is 9,000 less names on the list. And might I add that many of the names on these lists were people that possibly did not exist. I went to a number of houses where I was looking for this person. I talked to a person, and that person said they were living in the house their whole life, and that person that was on my list has never resided in that house, and that person has no connection to the PCA program. There were multiple instances in which I went to houses, and that person whose name was on the list did reside there. However, they have never been a PCA. They were never a part of any healthcare programs. They never received care. There was no relation to the healthcare industry with that individual. And like many stated before, I've experienced many other fraudulent or possibly just wrong information on the list that would lead me to believe that part of this list was either padded or fluffed with just fake names or what have you. And it's very concerning to me to see that, you know, that there is a union established to be caring for these people when the people, in my experience, clearly do not want this union. You know, obviously there are PCAs who want this union, there are PCAs who are in favor of it, but in my experience on the ground talking to hundreds of PCAs, they do not want this union. You know, it's like I said, it's concerning, and I won't give a name, but I was at a house where six PCAs lived. The mom, the dad, four kids, they all cared for one of the children in the house. When one of the sons, he was 14 when the union came to the door, and he said that he felt very threatened and they manipulated him into signing up for union dues, and he did not know what he was signing, that he was not well informed. They also told me that they had the union outside their house waiting for days and waiting for a chance to talk to them. And he said that, and that whole family admitted that they felt harassed by this union. And that, by that reason, and by many of these reasons, is why I'm not in favor of this union. It seems to me that they're not in favor of the people, that they're not in favor of the PCAs. I think they saw an opportunity to to tag along on a program and to make some money in the meantime, and I honestly think that's what's happening. I think some good has come out of this, the increase in wage that they accomplished. I think it's good. I don't think anybody agrees. You know, I think it's such a red herring argument when I hear, who would care for my son? My family member. Nobody disagrees with you that person deserves care. And so I would just encourage you to understand that everybody sitting on this side of the room and that side of the room agrees that these PCAs need to make more, they need to have better benefits, and the clients that they're caring for need the best care. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. And if they do, then that's an issue of their heart, and that's an issue with them. That's not an issue that should be discussed here. Thanks for your time, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your testimony.
I'm just going to do a quick wrap up. I see Doug Seaton's here, and then as I'm concerned, I'm done. I don't know.
I haven't acknowledged you, Ms. Crockett.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry.
And I actually have a few people on the other side that are on the list, and so I'm going to go back to the list.
All right.
Okay. I have a Jim Carlisle. Are you still here? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
My name is Jim Carlisle, and Philip's going to read my testimony. Members of this committee, my name is Jim Carlisle. My wife, who is also significantly disabled, and I live in our own accessible home, which we designed and had built in West St. Paul. In order to stay in our home and community, we rely on hard-to-recruit caregivers to get us up in the morning, put us to bed in the evening, prepare and service our meals, take us to our meetings and appointments, and to do so many other things that most of you probably take for granted, since you don't need to rely on another person's support. As clients in Minnesota's MA program, we have both depended on home care workers every day for more than 40 years. 40 years ago, our PCAs were paid $6 an hour. Today, they're paid $11 an hour. Do you know what the value of $6 40 years ago is today? $26. There was no progress in wages until workers formed a union. Then the floor jumped from 9 to 11 2 years ago, and it will jump from 11 to 13 if you approve this contract. The idea suggested by MNPCA this morning that they will win raises without this contract is laughable for those of us who rely on home care workers every day. This is why I was excited when a group of clients chose me to be a representative on the SEIU Healthcare Minnesota bargaining team that negotiated with the state the pending tentative agreement. One thing I brought to the bargaining team was decades of firsthand experience in trying to recruit and retain reliable, qualified home care workers at poverty wages. While the wage floor is now $11, hardly enough to make ends meet, thanks to the first union contract, for many years home care workers could be paid the state minimum wage. To support what I already knew about this challenge, our negotiating team reviewed and presented several articles, studies, and reports highlighting the critical shortage of home care workers in Minnesota. Another research report on the care crisis in our state just came out last week, and we've brought copies that have, I believe, been distributed to members of the committee or can be. The lack of adequate staffing in our home has resulted in times when we have not been able to fill essential evening shifts. The scheduled caregiver suddenly gets sick or more likely has a short notice engagement that's more interesting than earning $11 an hour working for us. Because of the deficiency of available, well-paid on-call help, we have found ourselves struggling over 3 hours to get undressed, take our medication, and crawl into bed. There have been times when we've had to call 911 for the paramedics to come just to pick one of us off the floor. Fortunately, as yet, no bones have been broken in our aging and stiffening bodies. The risks of costly hospitalization and recovery facility stays are greatly increased for the MA program when our allotted care hours are not staffed and our caregivers are not adequately compensated, so they leave us shortly after being trained. These conditions also amplify emotional stress and in some cases lead to fraud. By not sufficiently funding caregivers' livable wages and benefits, the state of Minnesota is contributing to conditions that markedly increase risks for poor quality home care and community-based services. Therefore, with the client's safety and the state's obligation at stake, I passionately urge you to give your resounding endorsement to the proposed new SEIU home care workers contract. Thank you for your time and consideration of this important issue.
Thank you, Mr. Carlisle, for your testimony. And the person that read the testimony, if you could just read your name into the record just so we have it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Philip Cryan.
Thank you, Mr. Cryan, for your reading of the testimony of Mr. Carlisle. Thank you, Mr. Carlisle, for your wonderful testimony. I have one more person on the list from SEIU, and then I believe Ms. Crockett had some closing remarks that she wanted to make. Is Summer Spica here? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
My name is Summer Spica. I'm a home care worker from St. Paul and a mother of four. I currently work with a deaf 10-year-old girl, helping her eat, taking her to activities after school, and helping her with her medication. In addition to doing this work I love as a career, this issue also affects my family. My husband has multiple sclerosis, which means he also needs to have a paid caregiver. I wouldn't be able to do the work that I do as a home care worker without the support of our PCA. Without home care workers, people like my husband and my client could probably end up in a nursing home before they're ready. I know I make a real difference in people's lives, helping them live independently and live with dignity in their own homes. I know I'm not going to get another job doing that, no matter how. I know I'm not going to get another job, no matter how much it pays. But it is very difficult. Our work has been undervalued for decades, which is causing the care crisis where there aren't enough caregivers who will do this work for the current pay and benefits to meet the needs of all the seniors and people with disabilities in our state. Our union and our new contract are helping to address this issue by fighting for better pay, benefits, training, and systems to really help fix this crisis. With the current conditions, I'm constantly stressed about making ends meet. We don't do family vacations. When I gave birth to my youngest daughter, I could only take a week off after having a C-section. It is so frustrating to hear the attacks against us because we are working so hard to improve the lives of our families. What are these lawsuits doing to improve care? How are they helping families in Minnesota live with dignity? This is the reality facing home care workers, and this reality is causing there to not be enough caregivers for the Minnesota families who need care. I truly hope the legislature will pass our contract to help address these issues.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Crockett, did you have some closing remarks? And then we'll go to member questions. I can ask them as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kim Crockett from Center of the American Experiment. Just a quick observation. This is the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, and I realize that all these issues are not before you. It would be the contract ultimately that's before you. And I'm hearing a lot of information about what people have been getting paid that doesn't jive with what I have from DHS and legislation. So disputes over pay. I'm also hearing facts thrown around about the election itself in 2014, which is the subject of this hearing. And so we would be more than happy to come back and discuss the contract itself, the current one and the one that is proposed, but obviously not at this time. I just want to point out that out of the supposed 27,000 PCAs in the state at the time of the 2014 election, that approximately 5,400 people did cast ballots and 3,500 voted for the union, which is about 13% of the bargaining unit, just to get our numbers straight. And the reason why we keep seeing this board flip back and forth is that MNPCA does have cards from over 7,500 PCAs now in the state saying, please give us a new election. And I realize that also is not before this committee, but it's part of the story. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Crockett. Does SEIU have someone here that would like to make some closing remarks, and then we'll go to member questions? No, okay. Now we'll start with member questions. I know Representative Roskowski had a question early on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe Mr. Seaton or Ms. Crockett could answer this. Can you tell us a little bit about the due structures that exist here? I'm wondering how much does the union take away from these home health care workers?
Mr. Seaton.
Madam Chair, Representative Duskowski, the contract doesn't actually cover the dues, but the union, because it has private sector representation as well under the National Labor Relations Act, it files with the U.S. Department of Labor a financial statement called the LM2. And the LM2 indicates, as best we can tell, that there are 5,000 low-income members of the local of the SEIU involved. And those members are charged 3% of their dues, 3%, pardon me, of their income annually, up to a maximum of $948 a year. $948 a year is, of course, a considerable sum of money for PCAs who are earning in the vicinity of $13, $14, $15 an hour. And that's the answer as best we can tell.
Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Seaton. I was just kind of doing some back of the napkin stuff here, and I know teachers I have in my head are usually pay somewhere in the vicinity of $800 per year, and the average salary of a teacher is somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000, give or take. Might be 53 or 56, I can't remember for sure, but that's about 1 or 1.5%. So this is significantly more, maybe nearly twice as much that's taken by the union from this group as is the teacher group. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, to that point.
Senator Simonson, to that point.
I just want to make a point on the record that the SEIU is not taking money from the PCAs themselves. It's a voluntary deduction made by the PCA to the SEIU, and I think has clearly articulated on the record, this is an open shop union. Anybody that wants to opt out certainly can. So I just want to, let's make it clear that we're not saying that SEIU is taking anybody's money. That is a voluntary contribution from the PCA to the union in order to be a full member. So I just want to clear that.
Thank you, Senator Simonson. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask a couple of questions about the election results that were put out, so I'm not sure if Mr. Seaton or Ms. Crockett are the proper people to answer, so they might want to both be there. But they gave testimony about the number of people that voted in the election and questioned whether or not the election should be valid. I have here that in Senate District 50B, the last special election, 5,039 people voted out of the 25,261 eligible voters for a total of 19.95% turnout in that special election for the vote for the state representative. And on February 9th of 2016, we have unofficial election results from that Senate District 50B. Between Chad Anderson and Andrew Carlson, where 2,582 people, 51%, voted for Chad Anderson in that special election. So a total of 19.95% of the eligible voters voted in that race. And in the special election for State Representative District 19A, the unofficial results as of February 12, 2013, Representative Clark Johnson won that election with 2,680 votes. That was 19.19% of eligible voters. Do you believe that those elections should be invalidated based on the same numbers that you are representing here, saying that we should invalidate the PCA election?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, you are talking about voters voting to elect representatives. That is not the same thing as a union election in a workplace. A normal union election takes place in one, maybe more than one location. Maybe there's multiple clinics. This is one where there was a union election with maybe 9,000, 10,000 workplaces, people that don't know each other, They don't live near one another. They don't even know each other's names. Some of them are just meeting for the first time here. You're talking apples and oranges.
Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I would say that there are lots of my constituents that don't know one another. I have a very high turnover between district elections. I have one of the highest turnovers in the state. Between elections, it's reported at any given time I may have at least 25% of my population turn over. I have a very high population of students who turn over in my schools, and the number one reason for that turnover is evictions from the apartments, which are very low-wage workers who live in my apartments. And so I think when folks are throwing around words like fraud, as a prosecutor, I take that real seriously. Now, if you are saying that people didn't vote, I can tell you there was a presidential election where people across the country are not happy with the result and they didn't vote, but we still have a president. I can talk to a lot of people going door to door that maybe didn't vote in favor of that particular president, but he's still the president. Now, I can tell you that there are special elections. I can go through one right after another. Senator Eaton was elected in a special election. We actually had very, very low turnout in the election, even lower than we anticipated. Yet we are not invalidating Senator Eaton's election certificate. What you are asking us to do is to say that people who voted and who now have the option to be a part of a union if they choose, they can opt out, shouldn't have that right to cast their ballot and have their ballot be counted. I think that's pretty outrageous, and I think that this process has been pretty outrageous, Madam Chair, and outside what we have typically seen in this committee.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. So let me just respond ever so briefly, because we did have people that had personal testimony that they didn't sign a card, they were enrolled in the union, that when they received their card from the union, it wasn't their signature. It wasn't just one, but it was, they have affidavits for additional people. That's one part. There's also the part of, I'm waiting from BMS. We have done, Senator Benson and I have done a data request asking to see proof of how many were actually mailed, and that will answer the question. And I so wish that BMS had the opportunity to present that, because that would certainly clear up a lot of things. But sadly, their commissioner died, and so they're not prepared to do that. So when we called this hearing, we were trying to be as helpful as we could and wait as patiently as we could with the commissioner's death. So unfortunately, that's an outstanding question. We don't know how many were physically mailed out. That would answer a lot of questions. So there were some questions that need to be answered. And I haven't heard somebody from SCIU saying that the folks that have given their personal testimony were not accurate in their testimony, or however you want to characterize that. But I think the questions needed to be asked, and we're listening to the answers now. So I appreciate the fact that Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have to say that I had expressed my concern to you that we not try the court case here. The legislature doesn't usually intervene in pending court cases. We see that all the time in the public safety world and the civil law world. And so it would be improper in many cases for people to specifically try the facts of the case here in this committee. And so so that's one of my concerns as well. I understand that many folks don't like the election results that they got. I understand that. And many folks want to opt out, and that is their right. Unfortunately, I don't have that right to opt out of the President of the United States, because I would certainly like to opt out of that election result that I was not happy with. But we don't have the right to do that. And so we have things in law and processes in law where people have a process and they follow it, and they expect that then that's going to be the rules. They don't expect the legislature to come in when there's pending court cases that they haven't been winning and say, well, we're going to put the finger on the scale of justice to make it so that the side we wish we'd won actually wins. And so that's one of the challenges that we have here, Madam Chair. We are supposed to be deciding whether or not to approve their contract. That's what we're supposed to be deciding. I haven't seen anyone call a law enforcement officer and allege that their name was forged in a criminal matter. I've heard nothing except from SEIU saying, we returned their money.
Now, maybe they didn't get it returned as fast as they would have liked, or maybe they didn't complete the paperwork in the fashion they wished they could have had it done faster. But those don't rise to the level of legislative intervention. And that's what you're asking right now. I mean, that's what that press conference was about. We want the legislature to decide that they should weigh in right now. And I just, Madam Chair, this has always been bipartisan, and I really hope that we can get back to that, because it has been great to serve on this committee for a long time. And I hope that we have the ability to continue to work together and actually solve problems for the state of Minnesota. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. And I would just say that I don't think we've come to any conclusions, but we certainly are listening to the voices on both sides. Representative Howe, I believe you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I heard it out there from testimony, and maybe I'm the only one here that doesn't understand it, but that's why I'm going to ask the question. Can someone explain to me the difference between choice and traditional, and what that means in their benefits, and how that process works as far as representation?
I believe we had two testifiers that, if you want to come back down and explain, that actually own the company that provides PCAs.
There's people outside.
Sure, sure. I just happened to notice they were wildly waving their hands. And so please state your name again for the record.
Hi, I'm Denise Kesey. And I think as a business owner, I can fairly explain the differences. If you are a choice client, that means that you have an agency like ours that will help you find PCAs, hire them, train them, supervise them. We do the whole gamut of what somebody needs to get a PCA into their place. We will hire them, we will employ them, we will do background checks. If you are a PCA choice, which is what majority of you guys are over here, we would just be the fiscal intermediary. We would pay their checks to their employees, okay? They get no support from their agency normally to help find any employers, to do any training. All that we do is a background check and write a check. Background check on each employee and pay their wages. That is what some companies do, not all. We treat our employees all the same. We do backup, we do the whole nine yards, but that is our company. A lot of companies that do PCA choice do not go that extra mile to help their clients. But it's company provides and helps find employees, or the client is responsible for all of that on their own. That is the two differences with PCA traditional and PCA choice.
Thank you. Mr. Gully, do you have something to add?
Yes, I would just, if I may, Chairman, Representative Howe, the difference between traditional and choice with respect to PCA comes down to what the client chooses. So if I am a person who is a senior or a person with disabilities and I qualify for Medicaid services, I have a choice of whether or not I want an agency to manage my care, or whether I want to manage my care myself and I want to hire my own caregivers who would deliver that care. And then I would use an agency to be the fiscal intermediary to pay the PCAs for the hours they work for me. But in choice, the client does the hiring, firing, training, and manages the day-to-day of their care. In traditional, they are hired by caregivers are hired by an agency and are managed by an RN, and it is the agency that manages the care, not the client. And the big difference is, even though they are both fully funded by Medicaid, that in traditional, the PCAs already have the right to form a union under the National Labor Relations Act. They're covered by federal labor law. And in choice, they're jointly employed by the client and the state of Minnesota. The state sets wages and benefits for the caregivers, and the client does the hiring, firing, and day-to-day management of the care. So that's the difference between traditional and choice.
Ms. Geist, do you have something to add?
Yes, and that isn't correct, because the employees are found by the clients in a choice care situation. The clients always have the choice, whether they're at traditional or choice, who they want working for them. You don't have to be a choice client. And that is in the Home Care Bill of Rights. You can have a client. You can have whoever you want working for you. You also have say in who comes into your house, what kind of cares you're getting, whether you are choice or traditional. And if you are a choice client, you are also supposed to, by DHS mandates, have a QP that comes in and supervises you. That is a mandate from the state. A lot of choice companies do not have that, which is against DHS guidelines. When you are traditional, you just get extra support from the office. The main difference between the two is the fiscal intermediary. With the choice, that's the biggest thing, and them finding their own and training them.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Geis. I think Representative Howe has a follow-up.
Well, first of all, let's be, I got an easy question, and then I'll go further into that. What the heck is a QP?
A QP is, they, I'm sorry.
That's okay, Ms. Geis.
A QP stands for Qualified Professional, which is an RN who goes in and only supervises what the PCAs are doing. She is not there to do any medical, any hands-on. She is only there to be a supervisor and a trainer for the PCA so that they are doing their correct job and to make sure that they are also working the hours that they are supposed to be doing, that time cards are filled out before the client signs them, that they are working the actual amount of hours that are on the time cards, that the employees are, PCAs are doing what they're supposed to do. That is what a QP does.
Thank you, Ms. Geis. Representative Howe.
So let me get this straight. So if I need a PCA, mm-hmm. and I just go put an ad out and I get a PCA, get a few people that respond and I check their qualifications and I decide I'm going to hire this person, do I really have to ask the question whether that's traditional or choice or what they fall into, or can I just operate like that? I mean, that, can I just, how does that work, or can't that work anymore? Has the state messed that relationship up?
Mr. Gully?
I would say that would typically, if you are qualified for Medicaid services, that would be in the choice category. So if you're hiring your own PCAs, that would typically be in the choice category. If you ask the agency to make sure that you had caregivers that were available to you and that were managed by an RN, that would be in traditional. But you would certainly have the right to say, I don't want a certain person in my home, but the management and the day-to-day, who does the hiring, who does the firing, who does the day-to-day oversight, in traditional is the RN, the QP, and in traditional, it's you, the client. Or excuse me, in choice, it's you, the client.
Representative Powell? Okay.
Just to
this point, Representative Lilly.
Madam Chair, I thought that was an interesting question. I'm learning here too. I don't really support what we're doing, but it's hard not to get interested and want to know what's going on. But what I'm just curious if, and I'm sorry I didn't catch your name.
Denise.
I'm sorry, Denise.
Ms. Gully.
Madam Chair, I was just wondering if she could tell me how, so we kind of heard on the union side, if they take like a union due, is there a cut that like you folks would take up to like a, you know, for pass-through or for helping out?
Ms. Geis.
I'm sorry. Like my business partner said earlier, we are mandated by DHS. All PCA agencies, whether they are choice or traditional, are mandated to give 72.5% of what we are reimbursed for each PCA. We are mandated to give minimum of 72.5% to our employees. The remaining goes for our overhead, my salary, our computers, all of that other stuff. 72.5% though goes to the employees. And that is why I don't understand why some people are saying that they were making $9 an hour, because that is not even close to the 72.5%.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the 27% is going not to, not to the workers, or maybe I don't understand I don't know, it seems a little bit more than the union too, so if I were, I don't know,
thank something,
I don't really have a question, but I think okay. You know where I'm going. I got to get the napkin math that Drez has going, but Representative Draskowski, but it just seems like there's 27%, and I know they have lights to pay for and stuff too, I respect that, it just seems like a lot.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. All right. I don't know that that actually needs a response.
Okay.
I mean, it's what DHS has determined in their rules. So, yeah. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It says a minimum, not a maximum. So the workers could get 100% or 99% or 98%.
Thank you.
But they can keep up to 27%. I would like to find out how much they actually do keep for each of the two testifiers that run agencies.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Ms. Geis, did you want to answer how much your agency does actually take? You said it was the maximum.
The minimum
no.
was 27, or 72% has to go to the workers.
Yes.
But 100% That's, could. So the question is yep. then, what is it, the percentage that they keep in each of their businesses when they could give their workers 100%?
Ms. Geis, did you want to answer that?
Yes, I would love to answer that. If we gave 100% of our reimbursement to our employees, there would not be a business. There would be nobody to do a background check. There would be nobody to do any billing. There would be nobody to do any writing of the checks for these people to have them. There would be nobody else to follow the DHS rules. So that 27.5% that we get operates our business, allows us to do background checks, which cost $20 a crack. And as some of you guys know, Mr. Carlisle, you said there's a huge turnover. If you have 30 clients or 30 employees a week or a month that work with you, that's a huge amount that's going to DHS for a background check that we have to pay. We also, again, we pay for training for our clients. Our company keeps, I think we have, I don't know, Carla has the numbers, and she is going to provide you guys with the breakdown of ours. We are above the 72.5% that we give to our employees, and that is our what we get for doing business.
Thank you. Mr. Gully, did you have a response?
I was just going to add that the 72.5% standard is on an aggregate basis across the entire group of workers. And so you can see a great variation of, in pay rates within a single intermediary or a single agency. So some people can be making $9 an hour, the state minimum, and others can be making more than what the 72.5% would be. So it is nearly impossible to audit whether or not an agency or a fiscal intermediary is actually complying with the 72.5% standard because it's not done on an individual worker basis. So I would just add that, like, even though we would applaud any agency or intermediary that actually does comply with the 72.5% standard, we have no idea whether or not that is done on a widespread basis. And in fact, based on our understanding, there is a significant amount of agencies and intermediaries that do not give the 72.5% to their workers.
Okay, thank you. I think we have another question, Senator Simonson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions, same subject, and at the risk of sounding a little bit like an HHS committee now, my first question would be, what is the reimbursement rate that we're talking about? We're talking about, you know, 72.5% and 27.5%, but I want to know of what. That'd be the first question. We can start with that.
Mr. Gully, do you know the answer to that? We may not have an expert in the room that might know that.
I do. It's $1,728 per person.
Ms. Geis.
I'm sorry, $1,708 is what a PC. What our reimbursement is for a PCA is $1,708.
Okay,
$1,708 per hour.
Madam Chair, to the testifier, is that per hour or per? Did she say that?
Yes.
Okay, per hour.
Mm-hmm. Senator Simonson.
That's it for now, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm a little puzzled as to why we're trying a court case here. My understanding is the courts have thrown this out. I work in the community as a mental health nurse and ran into lots of PCAs, and there's not a more dedicated group, and whether they're in the union or not is kind of beside the point as far as I'm concerned. They have that option, open shop, to decide to be in or not. And I'm just not comfortable with us litigating this here in this committee. It's just improper. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Eaton. I don't know that I would agree with that characterization that we're trying. I think we're hearing from the public their concerns and their experiences being PCAs. I think we're hearing from the public on both sides. We've given equal time to both sides to say the things that are going well, the things that are not going well, and I think it's our doing due diligence to hear the public. There is ongoing litigation. I think there is grounds to at least hear the public and what their concerns are, but I appreciate your comments. Any other questions from members? Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've heard people say they're not happy with our president, and I'll acknowledge I wasn't happy with the last one, but I didn't bellyache it about it at committee hearings. But I will say I hope that we, in our effort and responsibility in providing legislative oversight over some of this content area, take a look at the Bureau of Mediation Services. I heard Mr. Seaton talk about 7 different lists that were provided to them. I would like to, for us, before we proceed too heavily or too quickly into this area, to certainly get a chance to do our due diligence in providing that necessary and our responsibility for legislative oversight in that area. So I wouldn't, and you know, some on the committee think that we shouldn't be doing these types of things, and we certainly are not litigating the case, but there's some responsibilities we have in our legislative capacity, and I would hope that we fully engage in those. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rathausen. Are there any other? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could ask Mr. Seaton a question. Representative Draskowski just kind of triggered a question. I really don't have a great deal of difficulty looking at legislative oversight prescriptively going forward. But I'm sitting here wondering, I look at the sign, Mr. Seaton, it says why we need a new election. And my question, Mr. Seaton, is purely from a legal standpoint, how is the desire for a new election relevant to this committee's task in making a recommendation regarding ongoing contracts?
Mr. Seaton.
I am candidly seeing a real disconnect between the desire for a new election versus what this committee should do going forward with legislative oversight, candidly, on the existing election. Can you answer that question for me? And again, I think I'm looking at it from a legal standpoint. How is it relevant?
Mr. Seaton.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, the relevance we think is this. The original election, we believe, may have been affected by fraud or other misconduct, and we think that calls into question the certification of the SEIU to begin with, and therefore the status even of the current contract, let alone a new contract. In addition, we believe that if our decertification effort is successful, and we believe it will be ultimately, that will remove the exclusive representation certificate right of the SEIU. If the contract is ratified by this committee and the legislature, we have no doubt that we will hear that contract is a bar and will prevent any decertification election, either the current effort or any other, until 2 years down the road. So the request, unlike the representative's question earlier, this does not have to do with challenging the results or the turnout numbers. This has to do with whether though there really was a genuine election in the first place. And that's what the testimony of some of our PCAs, the findings of our canvassers, call into question, because there was just no one home in many of those supposed PCA addresses. So both because the original election, there may be reason to question whether that was proper. And under the law, the certificate of representation of an exclusive representative can be revoked, and they are revoked. It's not frequent, but it does happen both in the public sector and in the private sector when there is some some impropriety involved. Sometimes you have a union dominated by an employer, or you have some other fraud or misconduct or bought votes. Those have resulted in revocation of the certificate. So we believe that when the committee looks at the issue of, well, what should we do with this contract? This is very unlike the circumstance where one of the other bargaining units of real public employees comes in with their representative and has a contract that's been negotiated under the usual rules with a representation certificate that's not in question, where there's no certificate, no decertification effort pending. That is the reason for the distinction. We may have had an invalid certificate in the first place. We now have a decertification campaign underway that's a serious decertification effort. And if the SEIU's own comments are correct, there are only 19,000 or so PCAs in this bargaining unit. They're all the choice and the small, two other small programs that are represented in that bargaining unit. The group already has enough votes for the decertification to proceed, yet it is being stopped by the BMS. Now, if I could answer...
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Seaton, I understand that, you know, you have outlined a number of legal claims that you are making. So let me phrase the question a different way. Is the union that is currently in place the law in the state of Minnesota as of right now?
Mr. Seaton.
Well, we would say no, it isn't. With a decertification election pending, and that election is pending, we've submitted all of the cards, we're requesting the election, and we will be proceeding to both the court, the courts I mentioned, the Court of Appeals and the Ramsey County Court, where we have in fact been prevailing, as a matter of fact. We expect that they will require the BMS to proceed with an election or some form of process that would lead to an election. At the moment, they do have a certification in hand, but we believe there are good reasons why the subcommittee could say this contract should not be ratified until we have a result in this pending decertification process.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Seed, that's what I'm struggling with, I hear you say that you are making these claims in court for decertification and, you know, and a new election, etc. But I'm also hearing that the union as currently formed is in place, and that's, I need just a straightforward answer. This union is either in place, legally in place right now, and then that tells me one direction that we have to go. You may win your case. I mean, I don't know. But I don't know that, Mr. Seaton, I've ever heard someone tell me that the current law is, you know, this because we are making this claim in court. You understand what I'm struggling with here? Is this union in place legally right now under the laws of the state of Minnesota?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Seaton.
Senator Newman, we would say yes, it currently holds the certificate, but it is an invalid certificate in our view, and we believe that will come out in the course of the proceedings, and we think in light of that it would be appropriate for the subcommittee to say we can't ratify the agreement until we see the result of the pending decertification effort, which should be resolved in a matter of months, even before this contract is up. The contract, of course, only expires July 1.
Thank you, Mr. Seaton. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We have not, all right, Representative Draskowski, we do have a hard stop at 3 because the Senate is going to session.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Seaton, remind us of the timeline here. These contracts, I think all of them, expire at the end of the fiscal year. Is that the timing we have with this one, if I remember correctly?
Mr. Seaton.
Madam Chair, Representative Draskowski, yes, this expires July 1, the current contract of this year.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Seaton, and I raised this back in October when this group met under different composition. My question was, and maybe we should hear from the Department of Human Services, I think they're the fiscal agent in this, is that right, Mr. Weeks?
Mr. Weeks.
That's the department, Madam Chair and Representative Drazkowski, that gets the appropriation to pay the reimbursements.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Remind me, who does the bargaining again for the state in this one?
Mr.
MMB does? Okay, MMB does. Maybe we should hear from MMB then. The question is, where is the fire with this particular contract? Because as I've been around here, usually we hear the first introduction of, you know, contract negotiation success, or the first proposed contract language comes to us usually sometime after the first of the fiscal year. So usually after, it's usually July, August, September, somewhere in there. And I think Mr. Hubinger would probably would say that that's been his experience as well, because that's been mine for the last 9 years on this committee. And the question I have is, why did this come forward, and why is it coming forward prematurely? Now, one might say, and Mr. Seaton was outlining and trying to, I think, communicate to us that if we put forward as a legislature at this point a new contract this early in the process, it would become a bar for them to move forward further with their decertification effort. So one could certainly imply some motives out of that of either MMB or the union or both in that process. But maybe the gentleman has something to say about that.
Yes.
Mr. Representative Drazkowski, we have a hard stop at 3 o'clock. We've got literally 30 seconds, so if you can say that in 30 seconds, yes. Mr. Gulley.
Thank you. The reason the union bargains at this time, as we did 2 years ago when there was no decertification petition, is entirely related to the need for a Medicaid appropriation to pay for the raises and benefits that would fund this contract. We are not interested in receiving any increases in wages or benefits for PCAs that would come at the expense of the hours our clients get. And so we aren't interested in any wages or benefit increases that would not be accompanied by an appropriation. So you will see with this contract appropriate that we are seeking also appropriation to pay for this on a going forward basis. And that distinguishes us from the other collective bargaining units that you might see before this committee, is that we only accept wage increases that are paid for 100% through the Medicaid proposal process.
Okay, members, I need to check with the Senate over here. Are you back in on the floor? Because we cannot be meeting if you are in session.
We haven't received any notice that we're going back in.
Okay.
3 o'clock was a tentative time frame.
And how much notice will you get before you have to be back on the floor?
At least 20 minutes.
20 minutes. Okay, so then I think we've got just a few more minutes to wrap up. Are there any other questions before we let the Senate go? Mr. Seaton, do you have a response?
Yes, Madam Chairman. If I could respond also to Representative Drazkowski's question. Our belief, and we've said it for a year, is that we were afraid there would be an effort to get an early contract, and it is early, to prevent the forward motion on the decertification effort. And the Ramsey County Court found that the BMS and DHS and MMB had all refused to give us the lists in time to allow for an early process of the decertification support effort. So we were pushed into November, December before we could do that. We then filed a petition, and of course before the subcommittee are all of the papers from the BMS and that we submitted and their orders on all of this. But what they originally said when we filed our petition December 2nd of 2016 to decertify was, great, your petition's here, we're going to set a hearing, we're going to go forward to an election, and meanwhile stop the bargaining. No one is allowed to proceed with the bargaining, and that's the appropriate thing to do when a decertification election proceeds. And that was then quickly reversed after the SEIU interceded and requested reconsideration. But that is the normal process that's followed, and had it been followed and stuck with, there was an order to that effect originally from BMS, we would not be sitting in this position now. The subcommittee would not have received the tentative contract because they would not have been allowed to reach agreement. They might have been able to meet and talk, but not reach a final agreement. So our view is, and further response to Senator Newman's concern, if the original order the department, the BMS had issued had been stuck with, there would be no contract before you at all. And we think that's the appropriate order. We're going to seek to have it reinstated. It does get very murky, but because of that situation, we now think it's appropriate to say the contract should be held at a minimum, should not be ratified until this process for decertification can play out, and the courts can at least decide if we should be able to get that order reinstated so that there can be a fair access to an election process to determine if that SEIU is truly the representative of these PCAs or not.
Thank you, Mr. Seaton. Any final questions from the committee? Okay. Seeing none, I appreciate the presentations. I appreciate all of the public coming to share their experiences. And we obviously are not going to be debating this because they have to go back on the floor. And I'm getting messages that we need to wrap up. So we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep.